everyone, you're listening to New World Order Episode 19, Season 13. This is for 125-2019. That is the 125th day of the solar year 2019. I don't know, is 2019, I mean, it is a solar year. Is it the solar year? I don't feel like it is. Anyway, I got some listener feedback here. One is from a guy named Distro Junkie, and he messaged me on Mastodon. I'm going to try to start paying more attention to people who talk to me on Mastodon. That's not to say that I'm not paying attention to them. I mean, bring to light their messages as part of the feedback of the show. It probably won't last for long, but I'm going to make the effort. Distro Junkie says, I too used the Julian date calendar during my time in the USAF, that's US Air Force. The USAF kept track of everything and used an 80 character line to store information, using 2 digits for the year, 3 digits for the date of the year, or the day of the year. They were able to store a date with only 5 ASCII characters. They had manuals full of codes designating equipment, components, failure codes, actions taken, etc. We used a Burroughs mainframe, I don't know what that is for the record, B-U-R-R-O-U-G-H-S, mainframe, to store the date, the data with dumb terminals for input fond memories. It sounds very, very cool. I mean, to experience a mainframe in earnest seems cool, and you know, it's one of those things where I don't feel like you can ever capture that looking back. Like, even if you go to a place where a mainframe is running and you tinker around on it some, I don't feel, and I feel this way about a lot of things, but I feel like you really get the experience. Whatever experience it is that you're looking for, you have that experience when the chips are down, as they say. You know, when there is something on at stake, there's a deadline to be met, or there's some kind of, there's intensity. If it's just messing around with something, you don't really have that experience. And I think I started catching on to that, like with so much else, through Linux, because a lot of times I'd back way back when, you know, you would test a distribution, you'd try it out. Or maybe you're trying a new application out that is claiming to do something that you wanted to do. And so you try it out, and sort of in the comfort of your own home, in the lazy afternoon, you try this computer out, or you try this, distribution out, or you try an application out, and you think, yep, this is exactly what they advertised. This is great. This is very exciting. And then you try to put it into production, and then suddenly everything changes. Your view of everything changes. And I think that's largely with really anything in life. You put it into production, whatever production means, and your view on things that seemed one way shifts a little bit. And I think for a mainframe, I imagine that would be the same. You could go try it out, but you haven't tried it. You haven't actually used it until you have used it because things are depending upon it. I don't know that I'd want to use a mainframe that things are depending upon. I honestly don't. I'm not sure. I'm pretty comfortable with what I have right now, so I'm not 100% sure how I would like to emulate that experience. I don't know. I sincerely don't know what it's like, so I'm not really sure. But anyway, that's a thing. Listener Grant, I think. Yeah, Grant messaged me and said, and I quote, "Best podcast in the Linux world." You know, now that I mention it, I don't actually know what he was talking about. He was talking around GNU World Order, but I can't say for sure that he was talking about GNU World Order. I mean, he just says best podcast in the world. So, but it was in the context of GNU World Order. Oh, in the Linux world, by the way. I shouldn't leave out that part. And then finally, there was a message, a very useful message, which I think Ken Fallon will probably appreciate, because this is from Distro Junkie again, I think. Oh dear, where did it go? This is an important one. And he says, your music to me, he says, your coffee music, yep, it was Distro Junkie, your coffee intermission music is Zui der Zee by Lynn Stevens. I like the Dutch connection because I'm Dutch. So apparently, yeah, the coffee music that I play is a song by a person named Lynn Stevens. I looked up more of Lynn Stevens' work, and actually it's all great if you are into sort of, I don't know really what, I mean, it's really pop music from from the pre, I guess pre-60s is what it would be considered, maybe, is what they would call, they called pop music back then something a lot different than I think we think of pop music now. So if you like that sort of pop music, you will love Len Stevens. I highly recommend checking more of his music out. Really, really fascinated that someone took the time to identify the song. I mean, I'm sure there's technology these days that makes that pretty easy, but still, it's cool to get some feedback about that. And another one on from Mastodon, David emailed or messaged me and said that I first tried to create a flat pack for Bisq, BISQ, but failed because I couldn't get Bisq to build without relying on network resources. I needed to map out each dependency from Gradle. Gradle is a Java build tool which downloads dependencies. Snaps did not have this limitation slash feature. By the way, Snap can install a snap file with the dash dash dangerous flag. So this is class two again. I find this feedback or this report, I guess, interesting and surprising because from what I understand in Snap, so what's happening here is that, or what I believe is happening here, is that Flatpak and Snap both are considered sandboxes. That's what they're, for whatever reason, that's what they're called. And it simply means that you can install an application into this virtual box, I guess, that's, I guess, filled with sand. And you can sort of let the application play all at once as long as it stays within this sandbox. I mean, is that a limitation of sandboxes in real life? Are children told to stay in the sandbox when they play in a sandbox? I don't, that doesn't make sense to me. But anyway, that's what it is. So, I mean, it's more like a sort of a crib or a cot, I think is that what they call it in England? A cot? I don't know. You know where babies, there's a sort of a, you put them in a fence in a cage, babies in cages, people do that. But anyway, some people put them in sandboxes, and I guess they say, don't get out of that sandbox. And that's what's happening here, is that this application is in a sandbox. And so the theory is that it can do whatever it wants to do, but any kind of mess that it makes, now I'm getting at the analogy, doesn't exit that box, right? It stays within that sandbox. So in order to get outside of that sandbox for important, globally sort of significant things like a network or a specific daemon that maybe we wouldn't want someone to mess around with. But for this application, we're opening up permissions for it. So both Flatpak and Snap implement methods by which you can do that, by which the developer making the Flatpak or the Snap can do that. And in Snap, simply because it's on my screen right now, you do that in the definition file, in the little YAML file that you're creating to define what the Snap involves. And one of the things that you do is you grant it a specific permission, a security policy for a specific thing that Snapcraft developers have defined. And for instance, if you needed the network, as far as I know, you should be able, you should be required rather to define that. You should have to say plugs network, meaning permit this thing to attach itself to my actual computer's network in order to do certain things. That's what I thought. And you can see all the different interfaces that you can access in Snap with the command snap interfaces. So why David didn't have to do that specifically, I'm not 100% sure, really. I'm not clear on why it would not have been, it should have been restricted on in the snap as well as just as much as it would be restricted, for instance, on Flatpak. And Flatpak calls these same things, these security policies, portals. And so you can tell, you can give Flatpak your Flatpak permission to access, for instance, I want you to present the user's native file chooser dialog box instead of, for instance, the generic one that comes with the Flatpak, which personally I think is brilliant. I wish that was a thing for every Linux application. I really do think that there needs to be an abstraction layer for file choosers, but I've talked about that in a previous show. Opening URIs, printing, taking screenshots, even things like that, they need special permissions to get out of that proverbial sandbox. So why Snap wasn't restricting him to that, I'm not sure. As far as I understood, it should be restricting him to that. Now, that said, there are things that Flatpak, and this goes back to an email that Alexei sent me quite a while ago now, there are things that Flatpak just doesn't seem to be all that great at doing. For instance, being a command on a command line, right? And I've talked about this in a previous episode as well. If you want to launch the GIMP application from a Flatpak, you have to type in Flatpak run org.gimp with a capital or not with a capital, .gimp with a capital or not with a capital, I forget what. And you're supposed to remember that, and that's supposed to be the command that you use? I mean, that's insanity. No one's going to do that. That's ridiculous. And so then you'd have to go and say, well, okay, I guess what I will do is I'll make some location that contains all of the executable, I'll alias all the executable commands that I actually want, like GIMP or PDFTK or whatever. I'll alias those rather to the Flatpak command. And it just seems that seems messy, especially since you have to do that yourself. You have to maintain it yourself. And really maintaining yourself, I mean, that means you have to do it yourself, which, I mean, that's not that bad. But it's the things that change, and, you know, you've done something and then you walk away from it and you forget that you did it. And then you update something and suddenly your commands aren't working anymore and you can't figure out why until finally in the middle of the night, after hours and hours of banging your head against a wall, you it dawns on you, oh right, I have to re-alias that thing, you know, that sort of thing. We've all been there. And then finally I have an email from Claque, and he says, this is about the zip and the bzip thing. So he says, on episode 1313, you talked about how great it is that bzip2 can deduplicate two files, but it's not about the compression algorithm, at least not in the case as you described it. As you noted, the thing is that the zip format packs each file separately, whereas bzip2 is fed the whole tar archive as one stream with the data from all the files. This is a limitation with the zip format. Here is a list of archives that contain a 14K PNG file twice, 27K PNG.zip, so that's obviously both files twice, 14K PNG7Z, 17K PNG.tar.bz2, 14K PNG.tar.gz, and then 14K PNG.tar.xz. So in other words, actually out of all that, BZ two actually is the higher of the five listed. Well, no, I'm sorry. BZ2 is the highest of the non-zip options, which is four things. So 27 for zip, 17 for BZ2, and then 14 for 7Z, GZ, and XZ. The zip file was created with 7Zip, and 7Zip reportedly has the best zip deflate compressor out there. But there is nothing it can do to work around the limitations of the file format. With its own 7Z format, it clearly compresses the two files together, just like the TARs. 7Zip calls this its solid mode functionality. As a side note, BZIP2 had pretty bad overhead on the particular file for some reason. Now, when you have larger files, then the compression algorithm does make a difference. Here is an 828K FLAC file twice. So that's 1.7 megabytes for a FLAC.zip. So again, that's basically twice, right? 828K FLAC.7Z, 1.7 megabytes for BZIP2, again, 1.7 for GZ, and 828 for TAR-XZ. So 7Z and XZ both make use of the LISMA algorithm, designed by Igor Pavlov himself, the author of 7-Zip, and it has an exceptionally large dictionary size and compression block size, which is why it manages to deduplicate data almost a megabyte apart. The other algorithms have smaller compression block sizes, so they are too short-sighted to notice the repetition. I don't know how big the default block size is in XZ, but I'm guessing XZ normal compression is the same as 7-Zip normal compression, and there the block size is 2 gigabytes. He provides documentation about all of this, documentation.help/7-zip/method.htm. I will put that link in the show notes. I'm almost sure I will remember to do that. And it's super, super interesting. Really, really nice insight into the process, and also insight into why tests would render different results depending on what kind of file you're testing it on. You know, I would have thought, oh, I could just take any old file and compress it five different times under five different algorithms and compression schemes, and that speaks for that's the result, right, of that test. And I'll do it again over here, and that'll be the same thing. But actually, it would matter. It would depend on the size of that file, how a different compression type deals with it and compresses it. So it would be very confusing, I feel, if you didn't know this backstory that Clarke provides. So thank you very much, Clarke. That's great information. Really, really useful. Okay, and well researched, darn it. I mean, it's got references and resources and stuff, and that's always just citations. That's important, right? Okay, it's time for coffee. Okay, sitting back down here with my coffee in hand, ready to continue through the packages that are installed on a Slackware Linux, from a Slackware Linux installation. And of course, as you have probably heard me say before, but if you're new, you haven't heard this before, and that is to say that Linux comes with a lot of applications, a lot of commands, and a lot of us, very many of us, like all of us, pretty much, our dirty secret is that we don't know half of those commands. They get used by our computer in one way or another. They get used by other commands. Maybe we use them once every 5 years when we suddenly need something, but generally we're not super familiar with them. So we're reviewing all of them. You may not have all of these commands on your system because you may not have installed Slackware. You may not have installed all of Slackware. Who knows? Point is, they exist. They are often something that you will see on a computer, on a Linux computer, and so you may as well kind of get to know them. So here we go. We're in the util Linux package, which is a collection of lots of handy utilities for Linux. And the one we left off with mkfs, that's makefilesystem.minix, which we pretty much skipped over, and I'm not going to go back to it, to be honest. It's just, it is what it is. And next up is makeswap, mkswap. This sets up a Linux swap area. This is an interesting one, I find. Not for what it is, to be honest, but because of what it doesn't tell us. And the thing that it doesn't tell us is what swap is. So it says, make swap, sets up a Linux swap area on a device or in a file. The device argument will usually be a disk partition, something like /dev/sdb7, but can also be a file. The Linux kernel does not look at partition IDs, but many installation scripts assume that partitions of hex type 82, that is Linux swap, are meant to be swap partitions. Now, there's a warning, Solaris also uses this hex code type, so be careful not to kill your Solaris partitions. So in other words, obviously, make swap creates some kind of special designation for a disk partition or a file. That's what it says. That is what it tells us. But we still don't know what a swap is. And you can read the whole thing. You can read the whole man page, and there's no actual details on what swap involves, like why you would want swap, what it's used for. One of the references is fdisk and swap on. So if you read swap on, man swap on, it also doesn't tell you what swap on is or what it's actually used for. And I guess they're just making an assumption here that that people know what swap is, and I'm not comfortable really with making that assumption. I certainly didn't know what swap was. Well, it turns out that back on my old OS before I switched to Linux many, many years ago now, there was this thing called, I think it was called virtual memory. And it turns out that virtual memory was just space on a hard drive, like just allocated space that the OS knew not to use except in times where RAM was getting full of information, and it needed it, there was more information coming in, and so it needed to do something with the stuff in RAM that was currently there not being used, such that the more stuff could come in and have a place to go. So it would swap the, or I guess it's called paging actually, from what I understand. It will take all that information in RAM and write it to this space on the hard drive, and that way more stuff could go into RAM. So that's swap. That is what that is. That's the swap functionality. And apparently different operating systems call it different things, because I never heard it called swap before. I always heard of it. I'm pretty sure that the term that we used was virtual memory, and everyone pretty much agreed that that's what it was called. So I don't think it was just me making stuff up. I think it was in the settings, like in the UI of the OS. But anyway, there's a thing called swap, and that's what it does. You run out of RAM, you don't want your computer to just die completely or freeze up entirely. So you have to give it space, like an overflow, a RAM overflow space. What do they call that? RAM overflow. Anyway, swap used to be really essential because we had computers that had like 2 gigabytes and 1 gigabyte and 512 megabytes of RAM, right? Not a whole lot of room, especially as the hard drives got bigger. And applications got more complex. It was very reasonable to expect that you would be generating in some cases more information that you want to see on your screen right now, or you want to have being you want it to be processed, you know, this cycle of the CPU that doesn't all fit in RAM. And so your computer has to flip back and forth between, okay, let's move this data over here. Take this one in, we'll do our random access stuff, and then we'll move it back over there. And it would have to manage the memory in that fashion. I mean, it's that when you think about that, you really understand, I feel like, the complexity of computers. And the swap space is not ideal because it is slower, obviously, than RAM. RAM is famously fast. If we could run everything off RAM, we would. We like RAM. We like solid-state hard drives. They're a lot faster. Hard drives, not as fast, not as convenient for either the computer or you. So we don't really want to need swap, and nowadays, frankly, a lot of times we don't. I was surfing with no swap for quite a few years and absolutely loved it. I never felt like I was wasting precious hard drive space. Then one day I woke up and realized hard drive space isn't really all that precious anymore, and swap has another function aside from flipping data in and out of RAM, and that is hibernation. So hibernation is specifically when you put your computer so solidly to sleep that you are able to do crazy things like disconnect it from power. I don't know if you've actually done this before or not. I don't do it frequently, but there has been once or twice that I have done that. And you put it into hibernation, you can disconnect it from power, you can swap out a battery in a laptop, for instance. And then you turn it back on, it wakes up, it grabs everything out of that swap partition, or the swap file, as it turns out, and reapplies it to RAM. Your computer becomes awake, and it is in the same place that you left it before you hibernated it. It's quite magical, honestly. So this is different from just a suspend. Suspend is a lot less serious than hibernation. It's just when you're telling your computer to take a break. It shuts its screen off, it spins down the hard drives, it goes into a super, super low power mode. It's suspend. It doesn't require anything special from you other than constant source of power. If your computer, if the battery were to die, or if it was to get disconnected from the power while in suspend, then it would no longer be in suspend. It would be off, and you could, I guess, you could lose data, really, if you hadn't saved everything previously. So that doesn't rely on swap. Hibernate depends on swap, either a swap partition or a swap file. There are caveats to that because some subsystems that help a computer hibernate rely, cannot use, for instance, a swap file on the active file system. It can't figure that out. It can't do that. So you'd have to have some other drive where you could hibernate stuff to, if you were just doing a file or another partition or something like that, that would house this swap file. Not really quite sure on the advantage of that, to be honest, but I'm sure there is an advantage. I guess one of the advantages is that you don't have to have a swap partition pre-designated. You can just say, well, here's this other partition and I've got a lot of stuff on it, and today I want to hibernate, so I'll make a swap file on it, designate, turn it on, so turn swap on, and then tell the computer to hibernate. So there you go. Anyway, you can hibernate your computer without a swap partition, is my point, but you do have to designate a swap file in order to do that. Either way, whether you're making a partition for swap or whether you're making a file that is going to act as swap space, the thing that enables you to do that is MKSWAP, MKSWAP. I have used this directly once, actually. I was thinking about it, and I realized that there was one time quite a while ago where I was messing around with an install of Slackware, and I decided, I'd migrated like a bunch of partitions to a different drive, and one of those partitions that I wanted to sort of migrate off of my main drive and put onto some other drive was a swap partition, and I had to do a manual make swap in order to designate that as the new swap space, the swap area. It's a pretty simple, straightforward command, like a lot of these SBIN, UTA Linux ones have been. It's you can do make swap dash dash check to check for bad blocks while making your swap area. You can do a dash dash force to forcefully make a swap partition, whether the computer agrees with you or not. You can do a dash dash label and then give it a label. And this allows you to specify a swap space, a swap area with swap on, the command swap on, by label rather than by the UUID of that swap area, for instance. Let's see, what else can you do? You can do dash U to specify the UUID. Otherwise, it just generates one for itself. That's about it. That's the command, really. The example of usage they provide with the man page is to actually create a swap file. The process for making a swap partition is pretty simple. It is simply make swap and then whatever options you want, and then the partition that you want to create the swap on, and then finally the size of the swap partition that you want. Although it notes early in the it says the size parameter is actually superfluous because it specifies the desired size of the swap area in 1024 byte blocks. Make swap uses the entire partition or file if the size is omitted. So really, make swap slash dev slash sdx1, for instance, where sdx is the partition that you want, or the drive letter, sdx, sda, b, whatever, and one is the partition, so one or two or seven or whatever partition it is, and that will make a swap area on that target. Now, your next step likely is going to be a swap on command, but that's not yet. I won't go over that because that's not there yet. We're not at swap on. You can do the file, and that the example that they give for that is an fallocate, that's fallocate, dash dash length 8G, and then some label like swap file. That creates a file that's 8 gigabytes in size. It is called swap file, if that's what you called it, and then you could make swap on that file rather than on a device. Next up is pivot underscore root. This is a really, really fascinating one. And I think it is really low level. Likelihood of you finding this useful is pretty low, unless, until you need it. And that's how a lot of this works. So much of this is just just information until one day you realize, actually, that one command that was mentioned that one time could really be useful. Now, if I could only remember what that was. But hey, you'll remember where to look, and it's Yuga Linux. So pivot root is a way to do, you know, have you seen one of those magicians, and they yank the tablecloth out from under a set table, like a tea, you know, a tea set or something, or an array of wine glasses. They do it so quickly and so sharply that nothing moves. That's more or less what pivot root is. It is a system by which you can mount a new location for the root position of your file system, while simultaneously unmounting the old one. Now, I don't think that this command is really intended for people to use themselves. According to the man page for the system called pivot root, the typical use case for this function is during system startup, when the system mounts a temporary root file system, like an init rd, an init ram disk, and then it mounts the real root file system and eventually turns the init rd into the current root of all relevant processes or threads, but provides you your actual real root once all the processes are finished. So that apparently is the expected use of this. So using pivot root in real life is probably an edge case at best. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try it. So here's what we're gonna do. I'm gonna boot up this VM that I have. And while that's booting up, this is the CentOS VM that I was sort of talking about in the previous episode, raving about CentOS and RHEL. So I'm booting that up, and while I'm doing that, I'm just gonna quickly I'll do man 8 pivot root. By the way, if you're not super familiar, I guess man-k, I don't know what that actually stands for, the dash k. It doesn't stand for anything. It's the equivalent of apropos. So if I do man-k pivot underscore root, it tells me that there are two man sections that cover pivot root. One is section 2, and one is section 8. If I look in the man, if I do man-man, it tells me there are actually 8 sections in the man system. The second one is system calls, and then the 8th one is system administration tools and daemons. So if I do a man space 2 space pivot root, I get a different man page than what I would get if I just did man pivot underscore root. The default man page for pivot root is the user facing man page, the one that provides the command to pivot root. But if you want more information, you can look at man space 2 space pivot underscore root, and it tells you stuff that you might need to know from the Linux programmer's manual from that angle. And in this one, it tells you the typical use case for the function for pivot underscore root, and it also tells you a couple of restrictions, and it says the places that you define that you're swapping, the things that you're pivoting, the root directories that you're switching around, must be directories. They must not be on the same file system. That took me about an hour to figure out. Couldn't figure out why it wasn't working. Then I read man 2 pivot root and realized, oh, it has to be on this. It cannot be on the same file system, which makes sense when you think about it. But since it wasn't in the man page for the normal command, it didn't occur to me. It also says that your old root location must be underneath the new root, which also makes sense if you think about it, because if you're saying, okay, I want this to be the new root of all processes, then the old one has to exist within that new root, or else where does that old one go? So that kind of makes sense. And then it also says no other file system may be mounted on the old, on the location for the old root. Okay, so a lot of that doesn't make sense to you yet, but the command itself, if you do just man pivot underscore root, there's the command pivot underscore root, and then there's the new root location and the old root location, and that's it. That's the extent of the command. There are two options, dash dash version and dash dash help. So those aren't really options. I mean, they are, but they're not going to affect how you use the command. Okay, so here's how we're going to use the command, and that is, we're going to do pivot root, and then we're going to give it, just like the man page says, the location of our new root, and then someplace to stash the old root. And the reason you have to stash the old root at all is because you have to tell it, you have to give a place for all the running processes to resolve to, or else everything would just be killed very, very abruptly. Okay, so the VM is live and it's started up. So what we'll do is, so the VM has the original ISO that I installed it from still as a known drive. So it sees that as an optical drive or an optical media. So we're gonna mount that right now. Well, I'll just, in the desktop, I'll just double click it. Now it's mounted, great. So now in there, there's a folder called LiveOS, and in LiveOS, there's a SquashFS in it. SquashFS.img. So I'm going to mount that. I'm going to do a mount run media clat2 CentOS tab, because I can't be bothered, LiveOS, and SquashFS.img onto /MNT. So that mounts that onto MNT. Now inside of that, it looks like there is, if I look in /MNT, there's another file system in there called rootfs. All right, so I'm going to mount that over on /media. And I'm just using existing directories because I'm being lazy and there's not really any good reason to be methodical about it. So I'm going to do a mount rootfs.img /media, and then we'll cd into /media. And if I do an ls there, I see that it contains a root file system. It's got bin and boot and dev and etsy, firmware, lib64, lib, all the things that you would expect to see in your root in the root partition of a typical Linux system. So I'm going to cd into /media. Did I already do that? I don't know. I did it again. Do an ls. Yep, I see everything is here. So then I'm just going to do a pivot underscore root space dot space. And then we're going to, so what we're doing here is we're saying we want to pivot the root. The new root is going to be right here. This is going to be the new root. So we have all these applications available to us, which is important. But we need a place for the old root to be offloaded to. So sort of looking around, so this is a read-only file system on the ISO on this drive. So I can't make a new directory. So I'm just going to reuse an empty one, which lost and found is an empty one. But here's the MNT. That's mostly empty. Let's try it. So pivot underscore root space dot space MNT, and then press return, and I get nothing back. Return zero means success. So if I do, for instance, an ls, that should work, and it does. It works. Now the thing to realize is that that's not the ls from the VM. That's the ls from my new root. It's not really a great way that I can think of to demonstrate that, except, for instance, if I do a mount, if I just type in mount, it failed to read the mtab. And yes, it did. The reason would be because mtab usually is in /etc/mtab. And there is no /etc/mtab right now, as far as this system knows, because I haven't executed a chroot. I haven't performed a chroot. All I've done was pivot the root. And I'm not going to continue this process with chrooting, which would be, I think in real life, that would be the next logical step, is to do a chroot from here. I mean, certainly in this situation it would be. Otherwise, why did I just pivot the root? I don't want to conflate the two. So that is what pivot root does. You've just seen it or heard it anyway. That's what it is intended to do, and that's all I'll do with it right now. Next up is raw. Raw is, it's actually another pretty specialized, as far as I know, it's a pretty specialized function, but it is kind of interesting. It's certainly interesting to know about. So there are some things out there in the world that prefer to sort of manage their own journaling and in and out I/O processes, that sort of thing. And that sort of thing is usually managed, certainly if you're writing data and reading data, that's managed by the file system. But what if you wanted to just use a big storage device without necessarily having to deal with the file system on the storage device? So the way that you could do that, if you were such an application that needed that kind of control over I/O processes, is to use a raw device. And that is what the raw command is meant to enable. So raw, according to its own man page here, is used to bind a Linux raw character device to a block device. So in other words, you could almost think of it as a pipe, or you could think of it as a symlink. I'm sure neither of those is accurate, but that's kind of effectually the thing. It's very similar to that. And we can demonstrate this pretty easily, although not it's not very exciting, but we could do it by plugging in a thumb drive. So here's a thumb drive. It's got some data on it, but it's not important, so if I screw it up, it's okay. And I'll do an LSDLK, and so that the thumb drive I've just plugged in is SDG. That's the location of that thumb drive. I'm not going to mount it, I've just plugged it in. Now on Slackware, you have to do mod probe, and then R-A-W, mod probe space raw, in order to get that subsystem up and running, really. On the CentOS VM that I was messing around with earlier, I just happened to notice that raw was already activated. So it will differ from system to system, just so you know. If you try the raw command and it doesn't work, don't panic, just mod probe raw. Or if it's on another system, system control, start raw, and then you probably want to do systemctl enable raw to make sure that it happens all the time. Because what this raw system does is it messes around in your device tree. So if we do a /ls/dev/ra, I get a bunch of RAM entries right now. Here's RAW, and now I've got a raw CTL. This is on Slackware. Now on other systems, I guess in theory it could be pre-populated with some stuff, I don't know. But what we can do is we can create one, a new raw device, and point that raw device to a physical disk. Or actually, I shouldn't say that. I should say to a block device. A block device. I imagine that wouldn't, I mean, it doesn't have to be the physical, it could be, I mean, clearly it can be the partition, it could be probably an LVM pool, or a device managed by LVM rather. So it's just a block device. You can point a raw designation to a block device. So we're going to do /dev/raw/raw CTL. So we'll just make the first one raw 1, I guess, because that seems to be the tradition. I don't know why they don't start at 0, but they don't. And then /dev/, what did I say? It was SDG, right? Yeah. And then I'll hit return. And it says it's /raw/dev/raw/raw1, bound to major 8 minor 96. Great. There's not a whole lot to do from here, unfortunately, because I don't have a program that wants to write to a raw location. But I can come up with a vague proof of concept here, just to kind of show what is happening. You should not do this unless you are prepared to destroy a drive, so don't follow along here blindly. So first of all, we'll do an echo of the string GNU space world space order, and we'll redirect that, and again, do not do this unless you are prepared to destroy things, /dev/sdx, where that is the valid drive. In my case, it's SDG. So that's done, and now if we do it, now to get that information back, we should be able to do a dd and then if for input file equals /dev/raw. So you see what we wrote it to SDG, but now we're looking at raw/raw1, and then so we don't get a bunch of output, I'm going to do count equals 1, which I imagine is the lowest value I can put in validly. And then I'll hit return. And sure enough, at the very top of the output is the string GNU world order. And that's what I would have expected. So that kind of demonstrates that SDG in this case, since I bound it to raw 1, is the same as raw 1. Now, raw devices act a little bit differently than block devices, so you can't necessarily do all the same things. You know, how I just did the echo GNU world order, I just did that to /dev/SDG. Well, I couldn't do that to raw 1. It says invalid argument, so it doesn't understand how to redirect something to a raw device. So that there are things that work and things that don't work, and that's why I, instead of writing to the raw device, I wrote to the SDG device and then catted, essentially, dumped the information on raw. If you were writing an application that was designed to interact with the raw device, I imagine you would probably write it such that it actually spoke to the raw driver correctly, not through echoing and DDing various things. But that's the easy way to demonstrate it anyway. So that's raw. Not a whole lot to that one really. I mean, I'm sure there's a whole lot to using it, but in terms of talking about it, that's about it. I know that databases frequently there are databases out there that want to see raw devices as their destination because, like I said, they don't want to have to deal with a file system. They want to do all of their own optimizations and manage all that stuff themselves. So very interesting, very good to know about. Someday, if you ever become a DBA or someone who's doing like really high performance stuff, who knows? Maybe you'll use raw. Okay, next up is set serial, and that is to get and set Linux serial port information. Set serial is a program designed to set and/or report the configuration information associated with a serial port. This information includes what I/O port and IRQ a particular serial port is using, and whether or not the break key should be interpreted as the secure attention key, and so on. So, I mean, I've only ever used serial, I guess, twice, really. I mean, in a meaningful way. I mean, as a kid, I'm pretty sure I used serial all the time, but because that was the port. I remember there were serial ports and there were parallel ports, and we always had serial ports. So the serial port stuff, the serial interfacing that I've used myself as an adult, has been both with Arduinos and once with this prototype motherboard that I was tasked to do quality assurance on. And because, I wasn't doing quality assurance on the motherboard, sorry, I was doing quality assurance on the device that the motherboard that housed the motherboard. The motherboard was driving it. And so sometimes when you would reboot or when you would do an update or something, everything would break. And you needed a way to get information without really having access to low-level functions because this was, in some cases, friendly interfaces hadn't been flashed onto chips yet. So you couldn't just go into a firmware interface and grab information or anything like that. So sometimes it was useful to have a serial display. And so someone had developed a very simple LED readout that you attached to the motherboard, to the serial port, and you just saw all the text that was going through the computer at the time. And I think that's what a lot of people don't realize is that computers deal a lot with text, a lot more with text than people think. I mean, a lot of Linux users understand that text is pretty powerful, but people who aren't used to Linux don't really quite gather that computers talk in text. They do not talk in windows or graphics or GUIs or buttons. Those are constructs. Those are illustrations, really, and they represent characters, ASCII and Unicode, and ultimately zeros and ones. Of course, I say many people don't realize that. Maybe people do realize that, and that's why when someone sees you using a terminal to type commands directly to the computer, they call it, they you'll hear them sometimes call it programming or coding. And when someone said that to me the first time that happened, I just thought, I'm not coding, I'm just telling my computer what to do. And then you think, oh my gosh, that's coding. It kind of clicks, like, when you're a Linux user and you actually wield the power of Linux, you basically become a coder. Like you're coding things. It's just a very ephemeral and an instant and interactive thing. You're coding in real time, and none of your commands, save your history file, are really being recorded, and they're certainly not meant to be replayed at any time. But it's still basically coding. Anyway, I'm getting off topic, sorry. So the serial port here is it is created, they are created when you boot up. And we can see this. And in fact, the script that does this uses the set serial command. So I'll do a less on slash etc slash rc dot d slash rc set dot, dot serial, rather. And this is on Slackware. It would be different on a system using system D. And I've got this CentOS VM still open over here, and I was trying to look really quick, like for some notation about serial in the system D, sort of location, user lib system D, and so on. And I'm not really finding it. So I'm assuming that, kind of assuming that it's some target that I, oh, here, hold on, here, there it is. So possibly, and I could be wrong, but it looks like it is, actually, I could probably verify. Yeah, it kind of looks like there is a serial Getty target, or rather unit file for systemd, and it looks like that might be what's creating the serial ports. I could be wrong, it could just, this, I could be looking, no, it to me, it looks like these are the, yeah, it looks like that's the serial Gettys to me. And certainly the name of it would suggest that it is. But anyway, that's systemd. Let's look at Slackware. So in /etc/rce.d/rce.serial, there is a file that creates some variables, and then it looks to see. So it lists all devs, which is /dev/TTY S. Now these capital S TTYs are defined in a file called /etc/serial.conf. We'll take a look at that in a moment. And this file here says, okay, well, let's look for set serial. And so it looks in bin and sbin, uses whichever one it finds. And then it loads some modules and defines some functions like start, stop, and start. No, start, sorry, start, stop, and, oh, that's it, actually, start. I was thinking status, but that is not one of them, so there you go. And then finally, at the very end of this file, there is the command itself, which is set serial-bg, and then the devices that it found, starting with /dev/ttys, which, so the dash b, I think, I don't remember what that means in set serial. I guess I could look that up really quick, but this, the dash lowercase g means to take the arguments as a list of devices for which that the command is looking at. And then it looks like dash b is when reporting the configuration of a serial device, print a summary of the device's configuration, which might be suitable for printing during the boot up process during the /etc/rc script, which is exactly, I'm pretty sure, exactly what is being used for in /etc/rc.d/rc.serial. Let's take a look at /etc/serial.conf. It's a pretty big file, but most of it's commented out. Up here at the top, it says, oh, actually, this is all commented out. This is a sample. But I don't know where the real one lives. I know that these devices are getting created. And that is /dev/TTY S0-3 are the standard COM1 through COM4 ports. So if you're looking for a serial port on Linux, the standard default ones are /dev/TTY S0-3. Now, that doesn't mean that that's the only ones, right? Because, I mean, there is a set serial command, so that can be invoked and assigned to another place. So it doesn't have to be /dev/TTY S0-3 or 4-7 or anything. It could be something completely different. /dev/ACN0 or whatever. These are just the default, like the ones that are given to you off the top of the boot. So that's what set serial does. I don't know if I've explained that very well, but yeah, set serial simply says, hey, here's a device, here's a thing in a device tree, set that to be a serial interface. And then you can, in theory, interact with it. Now, in order to interact with a serial port, you have to be the right, you have to be in the appropriate group, and you have to be either the correct user, like the owner of the file, or you have to be in the group. I mean, that's how Linux works, right, is permissions. So if we do an ls-h on /dev/TTY S and then asterisk, we see that, -lh, then we see that all the serial ports that I have on my system right now by default are the file mode of each one is 660, so that's rw, and then nothing. So the owner can read and write, a group, which I'll name in a moment, can read and write. Anyone outside of either of those two things cannot do anything. So the owner is root, the group is dial out, and obviously if you're not either root or in the group dial out, then you cannot access the serial port. This is the cause of much consternation for people who excitedly come home with an Arduino or some kind of cool development board. They plug it into their computer, usually via USB, universal serial bus, and it attaches to their system in whatever way it has been told to attach. And then maybe you open up your IDE, and you try to flash the Arduino with your little test, your little blinky LED test, and it won't do it. And maybe it doesn't, I don't remember the error message. I've seen it a million times, so I don't remember what it is, but it'll tell you, hey, can't do that. And maybe you bang your head against the wall a little bit and try to figure out what's going wrong. Well, probably what's going wrong is that, the two classic problems here are that you are pointing your IDE at the wrong serial device, which generally, I feel like the IDEs are usually pretty good at, certainly I'm thinking, obviously, of the Arduino IDE very specifically here. But I feel like that usually does a pretty good job of identifying for you what you should be looking at. And the other, I think the real problem, the one that I see all the time, is that you don't have permission to access that serial device that you are looking at. And very frequently, the way to solve that is simply to add your user to the dial out group. Now, then you have to log out and then log back in. That's just a quirk of the user group system. They get loaded at login time, not reboot, just log out and then log back in. So if you add yourself to the dial out group with user mod -a and then -G. It has to be a capital G because you want to create non-primary groups. You just want to do additional groups. And -A is to append it. So this way you're not removing yourself from all other groups. You are actually adding yourself to that group. So user mod -A, or we could even do it this way, --append --groups. And then you could do dial out. And then the username, so CLAT2. I'm already a member of that group, so I'm not actually going to do that. And then you log out, you log back in, and suddenly you can talk to the serial port as expected. Okay, well, that's probably about it for the show. I know that the set serial one was kind of that wasn't a whole lot about set serial, the command itself. I guess, realistically, I don't set that many serial ports myself. In fact, I've never done that myself. And I don't know half as much about serial as I probably ought to. I don't know really a whole lot about baud rates. I don't know about a lot of that stuff. So while I would love to go over, the man page is pretty long. It's a couple of screenfuls. So there are a lot of options, and you can set lots of different parameters to be assigned to a serial port. I just don't know really enough about the serial protocol as to why you would want to change certain things. And I've never had a device that has demanded it. I guess that's the other thing. Actually, that's not entirely true. There was a device, a little onboard device of some sort. It was like a Bluetooth and Wi-Fi chip for an Arduino or some such board as that. And it did require a very specific, I think, probably baud rate. And I do think that I had to change it, but it wasn't that difficult. There was an option in the Arduino IDE, I think, on how I wanted to transmit. I'm a little bit fuzzy on the details because it was one of those things where I had a deadline, or I was just doing whatever was necessary to get the thing to attach to a network automatically, or whatever the problem was at the time. So yeah, that's my experience with serial. I would love to hear more about it, as a Hacker Public Radio episode or something. That'd be really cool. But set serial is the one that you would want to read up on and discover more about if that's the sort of thing that you find yourself needing to do. Okay, that's everything for this episode. So we only got, three or four more parts of util Linux down. Yeah, we did make, swap, pivot, root, raw, and set serial. That's respectable. Next up is SF disk and swap label and swap off and swap on, switch root, lots of really cool things. Maybe I'll try next episode to get through the whole SBIN. Maybe that'll be the goal. Get all util Linux through SBIN done. That's something like eight more commands. I might be able to do it if I if I stay focused. So, anyway, hopefully this was interesting or at least entertaining, and I will talk to you next time. Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @Klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, newworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time. Thank you.